Chapter 13. Psyche and Thanatos. Psycho-spiritual dimensions of death and dying. Part 2.
1. Experiences and observations challenging the traditional understanding of consciousness and its relationship to matter. The work with holotropic states has generated a vast body of evidence that represents a serious challenge for monistic materialistic science and its Newtonian-Cartesian paradigm. Most of these challenging data are related to transpersonal experiences. They suggest an urgent need for a radical revision of our current concepts of the nature of consciousness and its relationship to matter and the brain. Since the materialistic paradigm of Western science has been a major obstacle for any objective evaluation of the data that describes the events at the time of death, the study of transpersonal experiences has an indirect relevance for thanatology. In transpersonal experiences, it is possible to transcend the usual limitations of the body and ego, three-dimensional space, and linear time. The disappearance of spatial boundaries can lead to authentic and convincing identifications with other people, other animals, plant life, and even inorganic materials and processes. One can also transcend the temporal boundaries and experience episodes from the lives of one's human and animal ancestors, as well as collective, racial and karmic memories. Transpersonal experiences can also take us into the archetypal domains of the collective unconscious and mediate encounters with blissful and wrathful deities of various cultures and visits to mythological realms. In all these experiences, it is possible to access entirely new information that by far surpasses anything that we have obtained in this lifetime through the conventional channels. The study of consciousness that can extend beyond the body, William Rohl's Theta Consciousness, or the long body of the Iroquois, is extremely important for the issue of survival, since it is this part of human personalities that would be likely to survive death. According to materialistic science, any memory requires a material substrate, such as the neuronal network in the brain or the DNA molecules of the genes. However, it is impossible to imagine any material medium for the information conveyed through these various forms of transpersonal experiences as described previously. This information clearly has not been acquired during the individual's lifetime through the conventional means and channels, which is to say by sensory perception. It seems to exist independently of matter in some types of fields that cannot be detected by our scientific instruments, or may possibly be contained in the field of consciousness itself. The observations from the study of transpersonal experiences are supported by evidence that comes from other avenues of research as well. Challenging the basic metaphysical assumptions of Newtonian Cartesian thinking, scientists like Heinz von Fürste, Rupert Sheldrake, and Irvin Laszlo seriously explore such possibilities as memory without a material substrate, morphogenetic fields, and the record of all events in the universe in the sub-quantum psi field, or Akashic holofield. Traditional academic science describes human beings as highly developed animals and biological thinking machines. Experienced and studied in the everyday state of consciousness, we appear to be Newtonian objects made of atoms, molecules, cells, tissues, and organs. However, transpersonal experiences in holotropic states clearly show that each of us can also manifest the properties of a field of consciousness that transcends space, time, and linear causality. The completely new formula, remotely reminiscent of the wave-particle paradox in modern physics, thus describes humans as paradoxical beings who have two complementary aspects. They can show properties of Newtonian objects and also those of infinite fields of consciousness. The appropriateness of each of these descriptions depends on circumstances and on the state of consciousness in which these observations are made. Physical death seems to terminate one half of this definition, while the other comes into full expression. 2. Experiences and observations specifically related to the possibility of survival of consciousness after death. A. Phenomena on the threshold of death. Researchers have reported a variety of interesting phenomena that occur at the time of death. There have been numerous reports of visions and of recently deceased people by their relatives, friends, and acquaintances. Such visions show a statistically significant correlation with that person's death having occurred within a 12-hour window, even if the person died at a distance. Reports of unexplained physical events occurring at the time of death also exist, such as watches stopping and starting, bells ringing, paintings or photographs falling off the wall, and others that seem to announce a person's death. Individuals approaching death often experience encounters with their dead relatives who seem to welcome them to the next world. These deathbed visions are very authentic and convincing. They are often followed by a state of euphoria and seem to ease the transition. A number of cases have been reported in which a dying individual has a vision of a person about whose death he or she did not know. These have been referred to as peak in Darien cases. Near-death experiences, NDEs, that occur in about one-third of the people who encounter various forms of life-threatening situations, such as car accidents, near-drowning, heart attacks or cardiac arrests during operations, are particularly interesting. Raymond Moody, Kenneth Ring, Michael Sabam, Bruce Grayson, and others have done extensive research into this phenomenon and have described a characteristic experiential pattern that typically includes a life review, passage through a dark tunnel, personal judgment with an ethical evaluation of one's life, an encounter with a radiant divine being, and visits to various transcendental realms. Less frequent are painful, anxiety-provoking NDEs, experiences of a terrifying void, infernal imagery of ugly landscapes, demonic beings, and frightening animals who make loud, annoying noises. In our program of psychedelic therapy with terminal cancer patients conducted at the Maryland Psychiatric Research Center in Baltimore, we were able to obtain some evidence about the similarity of NDEs with experiences induced by psychedelic substances. We observed several patients who first had psychedelic experiences and later an actual NDE when their disease progressed, e.g., a cardiac arrest during an operation. They reported that these situations were very similar and described the psychedelic sessions as invaluable experiential training for dying. The most extraordinary and fascinating aspect of NDEs is the occurrence of veridical out-of-body experiences, OBEs, a term used for experiencing disembodied consciousness with accurate extrasensory perception. Thanatological studies have repeatedly confirmed that people who are unconscious or even clinically dead can have OBEs during which they observe their bodies and rescue procedures from above or perceive events in remote locations. An extensive study conducted by Ken Ring and his colleagues has added a fascinating dimension to these observations. People who are congenitally blind for organic reasons and have never been able to see anything can see the environment when their consciousness is disembodied during emergencies. The veracity of many of these visions has been confirmed by consensual validation. Various aspects of the accurately perceived environment by disembodied consciousness of the blind subjects ranged from details of electrical fixtures on the ceiling of the operating room to the surroundings of the hospital as observed from a bird's eye view. The occurrence of veridical OBEs is not limited to near-death situations, vital emergencies, and episodes of clinical death. Such experiences can emerge in sessions of powerful experiential psychotherapy, such as primal therapy, rebirthing, or holotropic breathwork, and in experiences induced by psychedelics, particularly the dissociative anesthetic Ketalar, ketamine. They can also occur spontaneously, either as isolated episodes in the individual's life, or repeatedly as part of a crisis of psychic opening or some other type of spiritual emergency. Robert Monroe, foremost researcher of OBEs, had spontaneous experiences of out-of-body travel himself over a period of many years. He developed electronic laboratory techniques for inducing OBEs and founded a special institute in Faber, Virginia, to conduct systematic studies of them. Life review, another important aspect of NDEs, is a fast replay or even reliving of one's life in its entirety or as a mosaic of separate events. Life review proceeds with extraordinary speed and can be completed within seconds of clock time. Some of David Rosen's subjects, who had attempted suicide by jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge, experienced complete life review within the 3 seconds that it takes to fall from the railing of the bridge to the water's surface. The direction of the sequence of events varies. In some instances, the replay begins with birth, follows the actual course of life, and ends in the life-threatening situation. In others, time seems to roll back from the situation of vital threat toward childhood, infancy, and birth. There are even some indications that individuals whose life review unfolds so that it moves away from the accident suffer surprisingly little damage. Yet another possibility is a panoramic life review in which one's life appears in its entirety, outside of linear time. Classical descriptions of OBEs can be found in the spiritual literature and philosophical texts of all ages. Modern thanatological research confirms the descriptions in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, Bardo Toldol, according to which an individual after death assumes a bardo body, which transcends the limitations of time and space and can freely travel around the earth. OBEs with confirmed ESP of the environment are especially important for the problem of consciousness after death, since they demonstrate the possibility of consciousness operating independently of the body. According to the Western materialistic worldview, consciousness is a product of the neurophysiological processes in the brain, and it is absurd to think that consciousness could detach itself from the body and maintain its sensory capacity. Yet this is precisely what occurs in many well-documented cases of OBEs. Naturally, people who have them might have come close to death, but did not really die. However, it seems reasonable to infer that if consciousness can function independently of the body during one's lifetime, it may be able to do the same after death. B. past life experiences. There is a category of transpersonal experiences that has very direct relevance for the problem of survival of consciousness after death. It involves remembering or reliving vivid episodes from other historical periods and from various parts of the world. The historical and geographical universality of these experiences suggests that they represent very important cultural phenomena. They also have critical implications for understanding the nature of consciousness and human beings, and for the theory and practice of psychiatry, psychology, and psychotherapy. For the Hindus, Buddhists, and open-minded and experienced consciousness researchers, reincarnation is not a matter of belief, but an empirical issue, based on a large amount of evidence and research data. According to Christopher Bache, the evidence in this area is so rich and extraordinary that scientists who do not think the problem of reincarnation deserves serious study are either uninformed or boneheaded. The nature of the existing evidence that one should be familiar with before making any judgments concerning reincarnation is described in mythological language in a passage written by Sholem Ash, a 20th century Hasidic scholar. Not the power to remember, but its very opposite, the power to forget, is a necessary condition of our existence. If the lore of the transmigration of souls is a true one, then these souls, between their exchange of bodies, must pass through the sea of forgetfulness. According to the Jewish view, we make the transition under the overlordship of the angel of forgetfulness. But it sometimes happens that the angel of forgetfulness himself forgets to remove from our memories the records of the former world, and then our senses are haunted by fragmentary recollections of another life. They drift like torn clouds above the hills and valleys of the mind, and weave themselves into the incidents of our current existence. Naturally, we need more than a poetic reference to ancient mythology. Careful study of the amassed evidence is absolutely necessary to make any valid conclusions in this area. As we will discuss later, this matter is of great importance, since the beliefs concerning the issue of reincarnation have great ethical impact on human life, and possible relevance for not only the situation in the world, but also its future. C. Spontaneous past life memories in children. There are many instances of small children who seem to remember and describe their previous life in another body, another place, and with other people. These memories usually emerge spontaneously shortly after these children begin to talk. They often present various complications in the life of these children, and can even be associated with carryover pathologies, such as phobias, strange reactions to certain people, or various idiosyncrasies. Cases like this have been described by child psychiatrists. Access to these memories usually disappears between the ages of 5 and 8. Ian Stevenson, professor of psychology at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, Virginia, has conducted meticulous studies of more than 3,000 such cases and reported them in his books, 20 Cases Suggestive of Reincarnation, Unlearned Languages, and Children Who Remember Previous Lives. He only reported several hundred of them because many did not meet the highest research standards. Some of them were eliminated because the family benefited financially, either in terms of social prestige or public attention, and others because Stevenson found a connecting person who could have been the psychic link. Additional reasons were inconsistent testimony, cryptomnesia, witnesses of questionable character, or indications of fraud. Only the strongest cases were included. The findings of Stevenson's research were quite remarkable. He was able to confirm the stories the children were telling about their previous lives, often with incredible details, through independent investigation. In all the reported cases, he eliminated the possibility that they could have obtained the information through conventional channels. In some cases, he actually took the children into the village that they remembered from their previous life. Although they had never been there in their current lifetime, they were familiar with the topography of the village, were able to find the home they had allegedly lived in, recognized the members of their family and the villagers, and knew their names. To illustrate the nature of Stevenson's material, the following is a condensed version of the story of Parmod Sharma, one of the 20 subjects described in his early publication. Parmod Sharma was born on October 11, 1944, in Bisali, India. His father was Professor Benki Bihari Lal Sharma, a Sanskrit scholar at a nearby college. When Parmod was about 2.5 years old, he began telling his mother not to cook meals for him anymore because he had a wife in Moradabad who could cook. Moradabad was a town about 90 miles northeast of Bisali. Between the ages of 3 and 4, he began to speak in detail of his life there. He described several businesses he had owned and operated with other members of his family. He particularly spoke of a shop that manufactured and sold biscuits and soda water, calling it Mohan Brothers. He insisted that he was one of the Mohan Brothers, and that he also had a business in Saharanpur, a town about 100 miles north of Moradabad. Parmod tended not to play with the other children in Bisali, but preferred to play by himself, building models of shops complete with electrical wiring. He especially liked to make mud biscuits, which he served his family with tea or soda water. During this time, he provided many details about his shop, including its size and location in Moradabad. What was sold there, and his activities connected with it, such as his business trips to Delhi. He even complained to his parents about the less prosperous financial situation of their home compared to what he was used to as a successful merchant. Parmod had a strong distaste for curd, which is quite unusual for an Indian child, and on one occasion even advised his father against eating it, saying that it was dangerous. Parmod said that in his other life, he had become seriously ill after eating too much curd one day. He had an equally strong dislike for being submerged in water, which might relate to his report that he had previously died in a bathtub. Parmod said that he had been married and had 5 children, 4 sons and 1 daughter. He was anxious to see his family again, and frequently begged his parents to take him back to Moradabad to visit them. His family always refused the request, though his mother did get him to begin school by promising to take him to Moradabad when he had learned to read. Parmod's parents never investigated or tried to verify their son's claims, perhaps because of the Indian belief that children who remembered their previous lives died early. News of Parmod's statements, however, eventually reached the ears of a family in Moradabad named Mehra, which fit many of the details of his story. The brothers of this family owned several businesses in Moradabad, including a biscuit and soda shop named Mohan Brothers. The shop had been named after the eldest brother, Mohan Mehra, and had originally been called Mohan and Brothers. This was later shortened to Mohan Brothers. This shop had been started and managed by Parmanand Mehra, a until his untimely death on May 9, 1943, 18 months before Parmod was born. Parmanand had gorged himself on curd, one of his favorite foods, at a wedding feast, and had subsequently developed a chronic gastrointestinal illness, which was later followed by appendicitis and peritonitis, from which he died. 2 or 3 days before his death, he had insisted, against his family's advice, on eating more curd, saying that he might not have another chance to enjoy it. Parmanand had blamed his illness and impending death on overeating curd. As part of his therapy during his appendicitis, Parmanand had tried a series of naturopathic bath treatments. While he had not, in fact, died in a bathtub, he had been given a bath immediately prior to his death. Parmanand left behind a widow and 5 children, 4 sons and 1 daughter. In the summer of 1949, the Mira family decided to make the trip to Bisali to meet Parmod, who was a little under 5 years old at the time. When they arrived, however, Parmod was away and no contact was made. Not long thereafter, Parmod's father took him to Moradabad to explore his son's compelling remembrances firsthand. Among those who met Parmod at the railway station was Parmanand's cousin, Sri Karam Chand Mira, who had been quite close to Parmanand. Parmod threw his arm around him, weeping, calling him older brother, and saying, "I am Parmanand." Parmod had not used the name Parmanand before this meeting. It is common for Indians to call a cousin brother if the relationship is a close one, as was the case for Parmanand and Karam. The intensity and genuineness of the emotions this reunion generated seemed in itself to be as important a piece of evidence as verification and information about external objects and events. Parmod then proceeded to find his way to the Mohan brothers' shop on his own, giving instructions to the driver of the carriage, which brought them from the station. Entering the shop, he complained that his special seat had been changed. In India, it is customary for the owner of a business to have an enclosed seat, a gadi, located near the front of the store where he can greet customers and direct business. The location of Parmanand's gadi had in fact been changed some time after his death. Once inside, Parmod asked, "Who is looking after the bakery and soda water factory?" This had been Parmanand's responsibility. The complicated machine which manufactured the soda water had been secretly disabled in order to test Parmod. When it was shown to him, Parmod knew exactly how it worked. Without any assistance, he located the disconnected hose and gave instructions for its repair. When Parmanand's mother entered the room, he immediately recognized her as Mother before anyone else present was able to say anything. He also correctly identified Parmanand's wife, acting somewhat embarrassed in front of her. She was, after all, a full-grown woman, and he was only 5. Although apparently possessing at least some of the feelings of an adult husband. When they were alone, he said to her, "I have come, but you have not fixed bindi," referring to the red dot worn on the forehead by Hindu wives. He also reproached her for wearing a white sari, the appropriate dress for a Hindu widow, instead of the colored sari worn by wives. Parmod correctly recognized Parmanand's daughter and the 1 son who was at the house when he arrived. When Parmanand's youngest son, who had been at school, showed up later, Parmod correctly identified him as well, using his familiar name, Godhan. In their conversation, Parmod would not allow the older Godhan to address him by his first name, but insisted that he call him father. "I have only become small," he said. During this visit, Parmod also correctly identified one of Parmenon's brothers and a nephew. Parmod showed a striking knowledge for the details of Parmenon's world. While touring the hotel the Mira brothers owned in Muradabad, the Victory Hotel, Parmod commented on the new sheds that had been built on the property. The Mira family confirmed that these had indeed been added after Parmenon's death. Entering the hotel, Parmod pointed to some cupboards and said, "These are the almirahs I had constructed in Churchill House." Churchill House was the name of a second hotel that the Mira brothers owned in Saharanpur, a town about 100 miles north of Muradabad. Shortly after Parmenon's death, the family had in fact decided to move these particular cupboards, which Parmenon had built for Churchill House, to the Victory Hotel. The reason why children remember their previous life might be the circumstances of death, particularly those involving shock that can possibly break through the amnesia. The most vivid memories often involve events leading up to it. Typically, these children do not know anything about events that occurred in the former personality's life after his or her death. This is an important point in deciding if it's possible that they could be unconsciously reconstructing the details of this life by telepathically reading the minds of those who knew the deceased, or if they possess these details as genuine memories. Possibly the strongest evidence in support of the reincarnation hypothesis is the incidence of striking birthmarks and various physical defects that reflect injuries and other events from the remembered life. Ian Stevenson described and documented a large number of such cases in his last work, Where Reincarnation and Biology Intersect. In evaluating this evidence, it is important to emphasize that Stevenson's cases were not only from primitive exotic cultures with a priori beliefs in reincarnation, but also from Western countries, including Great Britain and the USA. Stevenson's research meets high standards and has received considerable esteem. In 1977, the Journal of Nervous and Mental Diseases devoted almost an entire issue to this subject, and the work was reviewed in the JAMA. D. Spontaneous past life memories in adults. Spontaneous, vivid reliving of past life memories occurs most frequently during spontaneous episodes of holotropic states of consciousness, spiritual emergencies. However, various degrees of remembering can also happen in more or less ordinary states of consciousness in the circumstances of everyday life. Academic psychiatry and current theories of personality are based on the one-timer view. Traditional professionals are aware of the existence of past life experiences, but treat them indiscriminately as indications of serious psychopathology. E. Evoked past life memories in adults. Past life experiences can be elicited by a wide variety of techniques that mediate access to deep levels of the psyche, such as meditation, hypnosis, psychedelic substances, sensory isolation, bodywork, and various powerful experiential psychotherapies, primal therapy, rebirthing, or holotropic breathwork. They often appear unsolicited in sessions with therapists who do not aim for them and do not even believe in reincarnation, catching them completely off guard. Their emergence is also completely independent of the subject's previous philosophical and religious belief system. In addition, past life experiences occur on the same continuum with accurate memories from adolescence, childhood, infancy, birth, and prenatal memories that can be regularly and reliably verified. Sometimes they coexist or alternate with them. There are specific reasons to assume that past life experiences are authentic phenomena sui generis that have important implications for psychology and psychotherapy because of their heuristic and therapeutic potential. 1. They feel extremely real and authentic, and often mediate access to accurate information about historical periods, cultures, and even historical events that the individual could not have acquired through the ordinary channels. 2. In some instances, the accuracy of these memories can be objectively verified, sometimes with remarkable details. 3. These experiences are often integral parts of coex systems, underlying various emotional, psychosomatic, and interpersonal problems. 4. They have a great therapeutic potential, often more powerful than memories from the present lifetime. 5. They are often associated with extraordinary synchronicities. It seems to matter little to the psyche whether the pathogenic forces are related to events from ancient Egypt, the French Revolution, Nazi Germany, or prenatal life, birth, infancy, or childhood in the individual's present lifetime. The criteria for verification of past life memories are the same as those for determining what happened last year or 20 years ago. We have to identify specific memories as accurately as we can and secure independent evidence for at least some of them. Naturally, past life memories are more difficult to verify than memories from the present lifetime. They do not always contain specific information that would render itself to a verification procedure. Evidence is harder to come by, since they are much older and often involve foreign countries and cultures. It is important to realize that even memories from our present life cannot always be corroborated. Only some of them can. Most evoked memories do not permit the same degree of verification as Stevenson's spontaneous memories, which are typically more recent. However, I have myself observed and published several remarkable cases with highly unusual elements which could later be verified by independent historical research. One story that illustrates the remarkable nature of these observations involved Carl, a young American architect who participated in one of our month-long workshops at the Esalen Institute in Big Sur, California. At an early stage of his self-exploration, when Carl was reliving various aspects of his biological birth, he started experiencing fragments of dramatic scenes that seemed to be happening in another century and in a foreign country. They were associated with powerful emotions and physical feelings and seemed to be related to various aspects of his present life. Carl had visions of tunnels, underground storage spaces, military barracks, thick walls, and ramparts that all seemed to be part of a fortress that was situated on a rocky mountain overlooking an ocean shore. This was interspersed with images of soldiers, mostly fighting and killing each other. He felt puzzled, since the soldiers seemed to be Spanish, but the scenery looked more like Scotland or Ireland. As this process continued, the scenes became more violent and gory. Most of them portrayed fierce combat and bloody slaughter. Although all the people in his visions were soldiers, Carl experienced himself as a priest. At one point, he saw his hand holding a Bible and a cross. On his ring finger was a large seal ring. The vision was very clear, and Carl was able to recognize the initials that it bore. Being a talented artist, he decided to document this strange process. He produced a series of detailed drawings that depicted various parts of the fortress, including places to store food and ammunition, underground passages and tunnels, bedrooms, and the kitchen. Among these pictures was also a drawing of the seal ring with the initials. Carl created very powerful and impulsive finger paintings, featuring scenes of slaughter, including one that showed him being gored by a sword, thrown over the ramparts of the fortress, and dying on the ocean shore. It was interesting that in this lifetime, Carl's sternum had a very striking deep indention just where his chest might have been penetrated by a sword in the past life memory. This was similar to cases that Ian Stevenson described in his last major work, where reincarnation and biology intersect. These were instances where birthmarks, birth defects, and various other anomalies appeared on parts of the bodies which were seriously injured in the children's past lives. As he was recovering bits and pieces of this story, Carl was finding some meaningful connections with his present life. He discovered that many strong feelings and psychosomatic symptoms that he was experiencing at the time were clearly related to his inner process, which involved this mysterious event. A turning point came when Carl suddenly decided to spend his holiday in Western Ireland. After his return, he showed his family the slides that he had taken on the western coast of Ireland, at which time he realized that he had taken 11 consecutive pictures of the same scenery that did not seem particularly interesting. He took the map and reconstructed where he stood when he took the photos and in which direction he was facing. He realized that the place which attracted his attention was the ruin of an old fortress called Dún an Ór, or Fort del Oro, Golden Fortress. Suspecting a connection with the experiences from his inner exploration, Carl decided to study the history of Dún an Ór. He discovered that in 1580, at the time of the British-Spanish War, a small invasion force of Spanish soldiers landed in the nearby Smerwick harbor to assist the Irish in the Desmond Rebellion. After being joined by some Irish soldiers, they numbered about 600. They managed to garrison themselves within the defenses of the fort at Dún an Ór before they were surrounded and besieged by a larger English force commanded by Lord Grey. Sir Walter Raleigh, known as one of the first explorers to bring tobacco from the New World colonies to England, negotiated with the Spaniards and promised them free egress from the fortress if they opened the gate and surrendered to the British. The Spaniards agreed on these conditions, but the British did not keep their promise. Once they were inside the fortress, they mercilessly slaughtered all the Spaniards and threw them over the ramparts to die on the ocean beach. In spite of this absolutely astonishing confirmation of the story that he had laboriously reconstructed in his sessions, Carl was not satisfied. He continued his library research until he discovered a special document about the Battle of Dún an Ór. There he found that a priest accompanied the Spanish soldiers and was killed with them. The initials of the name of the priest were identical with those that Carl saw in his vision of the seal ring and had depicted in one of his drawings. In this next example is one of the most unusual coincidences that I have encountered during my LSD work. It also shows the complexity of this type of research. The evidence in this case has an ambiguous quality, since the experiences involved have combined characteristics of ancestral and past life memories. It is an episode from the treatment of Renata, a patient suffering from severe cancer phobia. In an advanced stage of her therapy, we encountered an unusual and unprecedented sequence of events. 4 of her consecutive LSD sessions had consisted almost exclusively of scenes from a particular period of Czech history. Renata had a number of experiences in these sessions that took place in Prague in the 17th century. This time was a crucial historical period for the Czechs. After the disastrous Battle of White Mountain in 1621, which marked the beginning of the 30 Years' War in Europe, Bohemia ceased to exist as an independent kingdom and came under the hegemony of the Habsburg dynasty, which lasted 300 years. In an effort to destroy the feelings of national pride and defeat the forces of resistance, the Habsburgs sent out mercenaries to capture the country's most prominent noblemen. 27 outstanding members of Czech nobility were arrested, brought to Prague, and beheaded in a public execution on the scaffolding erected in the Old Town Square in Prague. Many of Renata's experiences were related to various scenes from the life of a young nobleman, one of the 27 members of the aristocracy beheaded by the Habsburgs. She had an unusual variety of images and insights concerning the architecture of the period, typical armor, weapons and garments, as well as various utensils used in everyday life. She was also able to describe the relationships that existed at that time between the royal family and the vassals. Renata had never specifically studied this period, and I had to consult special books in order to confirm the reported information. In a dramatic sequence, Renata finally relived with powerful emotions and in considerable detail the actual events of the execution, including this nobleman's intense anguish and agony. In all these scenes, Renata experienced full identification with this individual. She was not quite clear how these historical sequences were related to her present personality and did not know what they meant. She finally concluded that these experiences must have been memories from the life of one of her ancestors, although this contradicted her personal beliefs and philosophy. Being a close witness of this emotional drama, I shared Renata's bewilderment and confusion. Trying to decipher this enigma, I chose two different approaches. On the one hand, I spent a considerable amount of time trying to verify the historical information Renata gave me, and was increasingly impressed by its accuracy. On the other hand, I tried to use the psychoanalytic approach, asking Renata for free associations for the content of her experiences, hoping that I would be able to understand them as symbolic disguises for her childhood experiences or elements of her present life situation. No matter how hard I tried, the experiential sequences did not make any sense. I finally gave up on this problem when Renata's LSD experiences moved into new areas. Focusing on other more immediate tasks, I stopped thinking about this particular incident. 2 years later, when I was in the United States, I received a long letter from Renata with the following unusual introduction. Dear Dr. Groff, you will probably think that I am absolutely insane when I share with you the results of my recent private search. In the text that followed, Renata described how she happened to meet her father, whom she had not seen since her parents' divorce when she was 3 years old. After a short discussion, her father invited her to have dinner with him, his second wife, and their children. After dinner, he told her that he wanted to show her the results of his favorite hobby, which she might find interesting. During World War II, the Nazis had issued a special order that every family in the occupied countries had to present the German authorities with its pedigree, demonstrating the absence of persons of Jewish origin for the last 5 generations. Working on the family genealogy out of necessity, Renata's father became absolutely fascinated by this procedure. After he had completed the required 5-generation pedigree for the authorities, he continued because of his private interest, tracing the history of his family back through the centuries. This was possible thanks to the meticulously kept system of birth records available in the archives of parish houses in European countries. With considerable pride, Renata's father pointed to a large, ramified pedigree of their family and showed her that they were descendants of one of the noblemen executed after the battle on White Mountain. After having described this episode in the letter, Renata wrote how happy she was to have obtained this independent confirmation of her gut feeling, that her ancestral memory was authentic. She saw this as proof that emotionally charged memories can be imprinted in the genetic code and transmitted through centuries to future generations. When I got over my initial amazement regarding this most unusual coincidence, I discovered a rather serious logical inconsistency in Renata's account. One of the experiences she had had in her historical LSD sessions was the reliving of the terminal anguish of the nobleman during his own execution. And naturally, physical death terminates the possibility of further genetic transfer. It destroys the biological hereditary line. A dead person cannot procreate and genetically pass the memory of his terminal anguish to future generations. Before completely discarding the information contained in Renata's letter as supportive evidence for her experiences, several facts deserve serious consideration. None of the remaining Czech patients, who had a total of more than 2,000 sessions, had ever even mentioned this historical period. In Renata's case, 4 consecutive LSD sessions contained almost exclusively historical sequences from this time. It is practically out of the question that something like this is a mere meaningless coincidence. And it is certainly hard to imagine any plausible explanation for this astonishing coincidence that would not violate some basic assumptions of traditional Western science. Tibetan practices relevant to the problem of reincarnation. Tibetan spiritual literature describes some interesting phenomena suggesting that certain highly developed spiritual masters are able to gain far-reaching knowledge related to the process of reincarnation. This includes the possibility of exerting influence on the time of one's death, predicting or even directing the time and place of one's next incarnation, and maintaining consciousness through the intermediate states, bardos, between death and the next incarnation. Conversely, accomplished Tibetan monks allegedly can, through various clues received in dreams, meditation, and other channels, locate and identify the child who is the reincarnation of the Dalai Lama, Panchen Lama, Karmapa, or another tulku. The child is exposed to a test during which he has to correctly identify from each of 13 sets of similar objects, the one that belonged to the deceased. Some aspects of this practice could be subjected to a rather rigorous testing following Western standards. If the reports about this procedure are true, the statistical probability of correctly identifying the right object in all the rows would be astronomically low. Apparitions of the dead and communication with them. Direct experiences of encounters and communication with deceased persons do not occur only around the time when these people died, or as part of the NDEs, but also at a later date, spontaneously or in the context of holotropic states induced by psychedelics, experiential psychotherapies, or meditation. Naturally, the data of this kind have to be evaluated particularly carefully and critically. The simple fact of a private experience of the deceased does not really amount to very much and can easily be dismissed as a wishful fantasy or hallucination. Some additional factors must be present as well before the experiences constitute interesting research material. It is also, of course, important to make a distinction between those apparitions that seem to satisfy some strong need of the percipient and others, where any motivation of this kind cannot be found. It is important to mention that some of the apparitions have certain characteristics that make them very interesting or even challenging for researchers. There are a number of cases reported that describe apparitions of persons unknown to the percipient, who are later identified through photographs and verbal descriptions. It is also not uncommon that such apparitions are witnessed collectively or by many different individuals over long periods of time, such as in the case of haunted houses and castles. In some instances, the apparitions can have distinct distinguishing bodily marks accrued around the time of death, which is unbeknownst to the percipient. Of particular interest are those cases where the deceased convey some specific and accurate new information that can be verified or linked with an extraordinary synchronicity. I have myself observed in LSD therapy and in holotropic breathwork several amazing instances of the second kind. One example of such is an event that occurred during the LSD therapy of Richard, a young depressed patient who had made repeated suicide attempts. In one of his LSD sessions, Richard had a very unusual experience involving a strange and uncanny astral realm. This domain had an eerie luminescence and was filled with discarnate beings that were trying to communicate with him in a very urgent and demanding manner. He could not see or hear them. However, he sensed their almost tangible presence and was receiving telepathic messages from them. I wrote down one of these messages that was very specific and could be subjected to subsequent verification. It was a request for Richard to connect with a couple in the Moravian city of Kromjerzyce and let them know that their son Ladislav was doing all right and was well taken care of. The message included the couple's name, street address, and telephone number. All of these details were unknown to me and the patient. This experience was extremely puzzling. It seemed to be an alien enclave in Richard's experience, totally unrelated to his problems and the rest of his treatment. After some hesitation and with mixed feelings, I finally decided to do what certainly would have made me the target of my colleagues' jokes had they found out. I went to the telephone, dialed the number in Kromjerzyce, and asked if I could speak with Ladislav. To my astonishment, the woman on the other side of the line started to cry. When she calmed down, she told me with a broken voice, "Our son is not with us anymore. He passed away. We lost him 3 weeks ago." Another example involves a close friend and former colleague of mine, Walter N. Penke, who was a member of our psychedelic research team at the Maryland Psychiatric Research Center in Baltimore, Maryland. He had a deep interest in parapsychology, particularly in the problem of consciousness after death, and worked with many famous mediums and psychics, including his friend Eileen Garrett, president of the American Parapsychological Association. He was also the initiator of our LSD program for patients dying of cancer. In the summer of 1971, Walter went with his wife Eva and their children for a vacation in their cabin in Maine, situated right on the ocean. One day he went scuba diving before lunch by himself and did not return. A systematic and extensive search involving the Coast Guard and several famous psychics failed to find his body or any part of his diving gear. Under these circumstances, Eva found it very difficult to accept and integrate his death. Her last memory of Walter, when he was leaving the cabin, involved him full of energy and in perfect health. It was hard for her to believe that he was not part of her life anymore, and she could not start a new chapter of her existence without a sense of closure for the preceding one. Being a psychologist herself, she qualified for an LSD training session for mental health professionals that was offered through a special program in our institute. She decided to have a psychedelic experience with the hope of getting some insight into the situation and asked me to be her sitter. In the second half of the session, she had a very powerful vision of Walter and carried on a long and meaningful dialogue with him. He gave her specific instructions concerning each of their three children and released her to start a new life of her own, unencumbered and unrestricted by a sense of commitment to his memory. It was a very profound and liberating experience. Just as Eva was questioning whether the entire episode was just a wishful fabrication of her own mind, Walter appeared once more for a brief period of time and asked Eva to return a book that he had borrowed from a friend of his. He then proceeded to give her the name of the friend, the room where the book was, the name of the book, the shelf, and the sequential order of the book on this shelf. Giving Eva this kind of specific confirmation of the authenticity of their communication was very much in Walter's style. During his life, he had had extensive contact with psychics from different parts of the world, and had been fascinated by the attempt of the famous magician Harry Houdini to prove the existence of the beyond. Following the instructions, Eva was actually able to find and return the book, about the existence of which she had had no previous knowledge. One of the psychologists participating in our 3-year professional training had witnessed a wide variety of his colleagues' transpersonal experiences during our holotropic breathwork sessions, and had also had several of them himself. However, he continued to be very skeptical about the authenticity of these phenomena, constantly questioning whether or not they deserved any special attention. Then, after one of his holotropic breathwork sessions, he experienced an unusual synchronicity that convinced him that he might have been too skeptical and conservative in his approach to transpersonal experiences and ESP phenomena. Toward the end of his session, he had a vivid experience of encountering his grandmother, who had been dead for many years. He had been very close to her in his childhood and was deeply moved by the possibility that he might really be communicating with her again. In spite of a deep emotional involvement in the experience, he continued to maintain an attitude of professional skepticism about the encounter. He knew that he had had many real interactions with his grandmother while she was alive, and that his mind could have easily fabricated an imaginary encounter using these old memories. However, this meeting with his dead grandmother was so emotionally profound and convincing that he simply could not dismiss it as a wishful fantasy. He decided to seek proof that the experience was real, not just in his imagination. He asked his grandmother for some form of confirmation and received the following message: "Go to Aunt Anna and look for cut roses." Still skeptical, he decided to visit his Aunt Anna's home on the following weekend and see what would happen. Upon his arrival, he found his aunt in the garden, surrounded by cut roses. He was astonished. The day of his visit just happened to be the one day of the year that his aunt had decided to do some radical pruning of her roses. Experiences of this kind are certainly far from being a definitive proof of the existence of astral realms and discarnate beings. However, these astonishing synchronicities clearly suggest that this fascinating area deserves the serious attention of consciousness researchers. Of special interest is the quasi-experimental evidence that is suggestive of the survival of consciousness after death that comes from the highly charged and controversial area of spiritistic seances and mental or trance mediumship, as I examined in Volume 1. Although some of the professional mediums were occasionally caught cheating, a number of others, such as Mrs. Piper, Mrs. Leonard, and Mrs. Verall, successfully passed credible research tests. An interesting innovation in this area is the procedure described in Raymond Moody's book, Reunions. Using perceptual ambiguity involved in mirror gazing, Moody induced in his subjects convincing visionary encounters with deceased loved ones. Some of the spiritistic reports considerably stretch the mind of an average Westerner, let alone a traditionally trained scientist. For example, the extreme form of spiritistic phenomena, the physical mediumship, includes, among others, telekinesis and materializations, upward levitations of objects and people, projections of objects through the air, the manifestation of ectoplasmic formations, and the appearance of writings or objects without explanation, apports. In the Brazilian Spiritist movement, mediums perform psychic surgeries using their hands or knives, allegedly under the guidance of the spirits of deceased people. These surgeries do not require any anesthesia, and the wounds close without sutures. Events of this kind have been repeatedly studied and filmed by Western researchers of the stature of Walter Penke, Stanley Krippner, and Andriha Puharich. A relatively recent development in the efforts to communicate with spirits of deceased people is an approach called instrumental transcommunication, ITC, which uses modern electronic technology for this purpose. This avenue of research began in 1959, when Scandinavian filmmaker Friedrich Jorgensen picked up human voices of allegedly dead persons on an audio tape while recording the sounds of passerine birds in a quiet forest. Inspired by this event, Latvian parapsychologist Konstantin Rodov conducted a systematic study of this phenomenon and recorded more than 100,000 multilingual paranormal voices allegedly communicating messages from the beyond. More recently, a worldwide network of researchers, including Ernst Sinkowski, George Meek, Mark Macy, Scott Rogo, Raymond Bayliss, and others, have been involved in a group effort to establish interdimensional transcommunication, ITC. They claim to have received many paranormal verbal communications and pictures from the deceased through electronic media, including tape recorders, telephones, fax machines, computers, and TV screens. Among the spirits communicating from the beyond are supposedly some of the former researchers in this field, such as Jorgensen and Rodov. Individual and social implications of the research on death and dying. The research of the psychological, philosophical, and spiritual aspects of death and dying discussed in this chapter has considerable theoretical and practical implications. The experiences and observations I have explored certainly are not unequivocal proof of the survival of consciousness after death, of the existence of astral realms inhabited by discarnate beings, or of reincarnation of the individual unit of consciousness and continuation of its physical existence in another body and lifetime. It is certainly possible to imagine other types of interpretation of the same data, such as extraordinary and amazing paranormal capacities of human consciousness, supersai, or the Hindu concept of the universe as lila, the divine play of consciousness of the cosmic creative principle. However, one thing seems to be clear. None of the interpretations based on careful analysis of these data would be compatible with the Newtonian-Cartesian paradigm of Western materialistic science. The systematic examination and unbiased evaluation of this material would necessarily result in an entirely new understanding of the nature of consciousness, its role in the universal scheme of things, and its relationship to matter, and more specifically, the brain. Mainstream academic science has been defending, often quite aggressively and authoritatively, its basic metaphysical assumption that human consciousness is the product of neurophysiological processes in the brain and is fully contained inside the skull. This position, inherited from 17th century philosophy and science, has thus far been impervious to modern discoveries, ranging from transpersonal psychology and various areas of consciousness research to quantum relativistic physics. It can be maintained only through the systematic suppression of a vast amount of data from various disciplines, a basic strategy that is characteristic of fundamentalist religions, but one that should not exist in science. Besides their theoretical relevance, the issues discussed in this chapter also have great practical significance. I have explored the importance of death for psychiatry, psychology, and psychotherapy at some length in other publications. Our past encounters with death in the form of vital threats through our postnatal history, the trauma of birth, and embryonal existence are deeply imprinted in our unconscious. In addition, the motif of death also plays an important role in the transpersonal domain of the human psyche, in connection with powerful archetypal and karmic material. In all these varieties, the theme of death and dying contributes significantly to the development of emotional and psychosomatic disorders. Conversely, confronting this material and coming to terms with the fear of death is conducive to healing, positive personality transformation, and consciousness evolution. As we have discussed in connection with the ancient mysteries of death and rebirth, this dying before dying deeply influences the quality of life and the basic strategy of existence. It reduces irrational drives, the rat race or treadmill type of existence, and increases the ability to live in the present and to enjoy everyday life activities. Another important consequence of freeing oneself from the fear of death is a radical opening to spirituality of a universal and non-denominational type. This tends to occur whether the encounter with death happens during a real brush with death in an NDE, or in a purely psychological way, such as in meditation, experiential therapy, a psychedelic session, or a spontaneous psycho-spiritual crisis, spiritual emergency. In conclusion, I would like to mention some of the broadest possible implications of this material. Whether or not we believe in the survival of consciousness after death, reincarnation and karma has very serious implications for our behavior. The idea that belief in immortality has profound moral implications can already be found in Plato, who in Laws has Socrates say that not being concerned for the post-mortem consequences of one's deeds would be a boon to the wicked. Modern authors, such as Alan Harrington and Ernest Becker, have emphasized that the massive denial of death leads to social pathologies that have dangerous consequences for humanity. Modern consciousness research certainly supports this point of view. At a time when a combination of unbridled greed, malignant aggression, and the existence of weapons of mass destruction threatens the survival of humanity and possibly life on this planet, we should seriously consider any avenue that offers some hope. While this is not a sufficient reason for uncritically embracing the material suggesting survival of consciousness after death, it should be an additional incentive for reviewing the existing data with an open mind and in the spirit of true science. The same applies to the powerful experiential technologies involving holotropic states of consciousness that make it possible to confront the fear of death and can facilitate deep, positive personality transformations and spiritual openings. A radical inner transformation and rise to a new level of consciousness might be the only real hope we have in the current global crisis.